and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump having to face a deposition on Monday and Bannon defying a House subpoena today, setting in motion several steps in a process to eventually have him held for criminal contempt and possibly at the end of the day outfitted with an orange jumpsuit. Joining us is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, now a Professor of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego, and the Executive Producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and a Legal Affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is "The January 6th House Select Committee is the Last Best Hope Against GOP Lies." We'll discuss how slow the process has been in bringing justice to those traitors who stormed the Capitol in a coup attempt, and when will those insurrectionists in suits and ties further up the chain at the DOJ and the White House and in the Congress itself be held to account. Then we'll examine the resistance movement of the rationals against the radicals in the GOP and Trump's bizarre call on his followers not to vote in 2022 and 2024, and speak with Miles Taylor, the co-founder of the Renew America Movement, a coalition of over 150 members and former members of the Republican Party calling for strengthening the rule of law and restoring government ethics. Having served as chief of staff for Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration, in 2018, he wrote an anonymous op-ed for the New York Times providing eyewitness insights into White House chaos, administration instability, and the people working to keep Donald Trump's reckless impulses in check. His subsequent book, a New York Times bestseller, is a warning, and he has an article at the Washington Post, "We Are Republicans. There's only one way to save our party from pro-Trump extremists." Then finally, we'll speak with an expert on Iran, Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, about threats from Israel that it not just has the right, but a responsibility to stop Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Since Iran is refusing to negotiate to revive the stalled indirect nuclear talks with the U.S., the French foreign minister is warning the situation has reached, quote, a crisis at a critical moment, since Iran is creating facts on the ground as it gets closer to a bomb, which Israel will not tolerate. And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and a legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times. And the Talking Feds podcast has a new feature, Talking Books, which just featured Fiona Hill yesterday. And today will feature Bob Woodward and Robert Costa on their new book, Peril. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Harry. And let's begin with this breaking news where Trump has been ordered to give a deposition in a 2015 case involving an assault during a Trump Tower demonstration. Group of human rights activists of Mexican origin were protesting Trump's rhetoric on immigration as he came down the famous escalator talking about the Mexicans being a bunch of rapists and murderers. And it looks as if, from what we understand from the video, that Trump's then head of security, Keith Schiller, hit one of the protests, Efrain Galicia, on the head and ripped up his sign that read, "Trump, make America racist again." So he's supposed to be deposed on Monday morning at the Trump Organization headquarters in New York City. How significant is that?
You know, I think the fact of it, Ian, is pretty significant. He's managed to run through the raindrops through his whole presidency, and this will be the first time in many years he's actually been forced to raise his right hand. And there may be others in the offing, and the most significant is the kind of aspect of this is the kind of chink in the armor that I think will embolden other judges, and there are a few that are, you know, ready to pull the trigger in the next couple months. In this case, I think, inveterate liar as though he may be, he's probably can skate through with a lot of I don't knows or I don't recall. I was just up there in the C-suite while my goons were banging heads down below. So, you know, they'll ask him questions maybe about overall policies, and he'll I think just bob and weave. However, there are now the two defamation cases that are really sexual assault cases, where he has denied allegations of sexual assault and was sued for defamation. One of them is due to have discovery end by the end of December. And the other is the one that the Department of Justice has said they'll represent Trump. But nevertheless, the district court is moving forward with, even as that is in the D.C. Circuit. And again, don't forget the district attorney in Manhattan, Cyrus Vance Jr., who says he's leaving office by the end of the year, and he's going to want to make charging decisions. He's got Trump's tax returns. So I think this is a precarious 60 to 90 days for Trump. Nevertheless, Monday, a skilled prevaricator such as he is, I think will be able to just basically stumble and bumble his way out of saying any clearly perjurious statement. And that's the very final point. I think now there is, he's the former president and he's known broadly to be a liar. If he lies in any of these depositions, I think you will see district attorneys ready to come in and indict him for perjury. And that's a really tangible risk for him over every time he has to sit for depositions.
So let's turn to his former aide, who the deadline for Steve Bannon to respond to the House Select Committees on investigating the January 6th insurrection subpoena. They've issued 19 subpoenas so far, and he's rejected it. The time ran out today. The chair of the committee, Benny Thompson, said, "We reject Bannon's position entirely. The Select Committee will not tolerate defiance of our subpoenas, so we must move forward with proceeding to refer Mr. Bannon for criminal contempt." Now, the process, from what I understand, Harry, is that the committee meets on October the 19th, and then they would vote for contempt, and then it would have to go to the full House for a vote. And then if that vote succeeds, then Speaker Pelosi certifies the report to the U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia. But there's also an alternative scenario, isn't it, where the Justice Department can also pick it up? So walk us through the steps that we'll take before we see either Bannon in an orange jumpsuit, or what would the alternative be? Being forced to testify?
And this is a shame because, well, as I see it, Ian, I think I'm generally less sanguine than many of my colleagues here, because Bannon in particular has a very weak claim to executive privilege. He wasn't in the executive branch at the time. It had been years since he was. And the issue is, however, can he somehow get into court? You know, Trump had many weak claims during impeachment as well, but he was able to bring them to court and then capitalize on this terrible disconnect between how long it takes to go through the federal courts, 18 months to 2 years, and how long Congress has to do a viable or effective investigation, here probably to, you know, into the summer. So it's interesting that they chose him first and he's their best case because they have another hurdle first, and that is the Department of Justice. Has he committed a crime by not showing up, you know, flagrantly? Yes, is the answer. But crimes have to be prosecuted by the DOJ, and they have a policy of keeping their hands off and not prosecuting crimes when they involve former or current executive branch officials. So what is Merrick Garland going to do? They also have a policy of asserting executive privilege, which they have made an exception for given the inordinate importance of getting to the bottom of January 6th. Will they also make the exception and bring a criminal charge against Bannon? You know, it's not exactly in Merrick Garland's style to do that, and they will be worried what happens when the shoe is on the other foot. But if ever they will do it, it will be against Bannon because they could take the position this isn't even vaguely within the realm of a valid executive prosecution claim. And here's the whole point. If they do that, then there's a cost. To date, in the other ways that Congress have tried to enforce, mainly by having civil contempt and taking someone to court, it's been a free ride for them. They go 18 months, 2 years, and then they walk. Here, Bannon will be rolling the dice, hoping the department doesn't do it, because if they do and they win, as you say, orange jumpsuit time. So what the Congress desperately needs, and current law is, it's not clear it provides them, is some kind of leverage so that when people are recalcitrant and they push back, they have the possibility of putting them under real risk of serious penalty, financial or jail. So the criminal referral, the civil didn't work before. The so-called inherent contempt won't work. Hasn't been done for over 100 years. This is their best shot, but now they run into DOJ. But this is their best shot at getting DOJ to make an exception. If DOJ here says we're taking a pass, we will not refer Steve Bannon, I think the whole enterprise is going to come down just to who will speak to them voluntarily, because anyone who resists, I think, will wind up having a free pass.
And again, I'm speaking with Harry Lipman, a former United States attorney and deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and a legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times. And he has a new feature at the Talking Feds podcast, which is Talking Books, which just featured Fiona Hill and today has Bob Woodward and Robert Costa talking about their new book, Peril. And of course, we've seen Trump, his MO is to run out the clock.
Absolutely.
But this is also, though, and you wrote a piece recently in the LA Times, the January 6th House Select Committee is the last best hope against GOP lies. Well, the reason I think you're correct in making that assertion is that so far it's been incredibly slow to get any justice, any transparency about what happened on January the 6th. We've been waiting for months and months and months. There's been criticism of Merrick Garland being soft on these insurgents, these criminals. And now, of course, you've got Adam Schiff now referring to people like Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader in the House, as insurgents in suits and ties.
Yeah.
I mean, what's going on here? Why can't we get some justice? It's taking forever. And these guys are skilled at running out the clock.
They are. And more fundamental, it seems to me, even than justice, is just truth. And as a society, we are entitled to know everything that happened. We have, you know, compare this to, say, 9/11 or to JFK assassination or whatever. We really deserve the truth, and Trump has managed to stymie it. I wouldn't jump too quickly to the conclusion that they're not really working this within the department. It's the biggest criminal case in numbers they've ever had, and they have to work their way up. And they've gone from the kind of hangers-on to the real conspirators at the 3% or terrorist level. And they just have to now, it's, I think, look into the McCarthys of the world. That doesn't mean, though, that they'll bring a case. And, of course, when they don't, they keep their mouth shut, at least in a proper professional department like Merrick Garland's is. So I don't think he's going soft on them. I think he's going, you know, methodically. But it will be a tough, pressure-filled decision if he actually has possible criminal cases to file against people like, well, Trump himself, but Trump's family, Mark Meadows. There were a lot of, you know, as best we know, sort of miscreants in the January 6th and the lead up to it and even the aftermath. So, you know, they are going methodically. This is not slow for the kind of case it is. Nevertheless, it's certainly possible that at the end of the day, the disappointment people feel now will be multiplied by orders of magnitude, because once again, Trump and his acolytes will escape criminal charges, at least from this episode.
And in filling the vacuum, and since it's taken so long, of course, is Trump with the latest lies, where he's turning these insurgents and traitors into heroes and martyrs.
And trying to make the election literally about this, you know, so literally the whole strategy is to try to continue to inflame the country and to make the big lie actually the fighting ground. That's just toxic for democracy. And God knows how the Republican Party is going to get themselves out of this cesspool, because right now they're enthralled to him. And that means they have to, you know, get in line with a sort of story that they know is completely bogus.
So let's talk about the subpoena that actually was served on Wednesday on Jeffrey Clark, who was all too willing to do Trump's bidding. In fact, I think he even wanted to become an acting attorney general. Jeffrey Rosen and Donahue stood up, did the right thing, but Clark clearly was eager to do Trump's bidding and turn the Justice Department into an adjunct, if you will, of the big lie. What's the story there? I mean, he's a part of this Kirkland and Ellis group that include Barr and also Ken Starr and a whole bunch of these.
He actually then was at a school that has just fired him. He's in the soup, I think, Ian, or at least it's not easy for him to walk away. He made a classic Faustian bargain. He was the port in a storm that Trump finally found who would do his bidding. And he was an absolute traitor to the Constitution and a jerk. Besides, he goes to the acting attorney general and says, Trump wants to put me in your job, but I'll decide not to take it if you'll sign these completely false letters that also, by the way, intervene in an election and were wrong six ways from Sunday. And then they have a showdown in the Oval Office for 3 hours, January 3rd, at the end of which everybody, all the people, and by the way, Clark, you know, it's a fairly elevated job, but it's not in the top four positions in the department. And he was an acting player, and everybody above him, everybody in the White House said, we resign if you do this. This is going to make the Saturday Night Massacre, you know, look like a little retirement party. So Trump really had no way to go forward. And what Trump did and what Clark was proposing to do was deeply unlawful and anti-constitutional as well as unconstitutional. So he's a real, you know, punk, I think, in addition to being a lawbreaker. Now, here's his problem. He could try to play it with Trump, and, you know, his conversations from him to Trump feel more like executive privilege would cover them than others would. Of course, the Biden administration says they don't. That's a different issue. But Rosen, who was the acting attorney general and one of the people who said he'd resign, talked to the committee for 10 hours yesterday. As you say, Donahue is doing it. Basically, everybody is giving him up. and he's got an IG investigation for violating DOJ principles. He's got a bar investigation about him, and he could lose his license, which he needs. He has possible criminal exposure. So it's just harder for him to sit back and let everybody paint the story with him as the central villain. Nevertheless, you know, it might be better than coming forward and actually talking. But he is someone who really has a lot of pressure on both sides. He's in a vise, and we'll see how he handles it. If he tries to be, you know, intransigent, he's going to be even a more disreputable figure than he is already come 6 months from now. And, you know, he'll be ruined, but maybe the alternative is going to jail. So
even if Clark doesn't end up in an orange jumpsuit, at least he'll be ostracized. And that seems to be happening to John Eastman, who wrote this appalling memo and met in the White House with Trump and tried to get Vice President Pence to throw the election for Trump. He's being ostracized, although the Claremont Institute out here in California is standing by him. So is that, to your mind, sufficient punishment for Eastman?
No. And Eastman, to me, is more dangerous. It's a completely bankrupt memo also, but lawyers, I think, tend to be more shaken up by it because his basic strategy was a way of sort of bypassing the courts, just having Pence declare it a fait accompli, and then there's a whole mess and chaos, and maybe when all the pieces settle out, you know, the court lets it happen. That could still be a game plan in 22 and 24. This is a guy with good credentials who really should know better, and his pernicious proposals, I think, are still much more live than Clark's were. So he's got to, I think, be, you know, really beaten into the ground. His ideas have to be more even than they have been so far.
Well, Harry Litman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Always a pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Harry Litman, a former United States attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and a legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times. And he has a new feature at the Talking Feds podcast, Talking Books, which just featured Fiona Hill and today has Bob Woodward and Robert Costa talking about their new book, Peril. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the resistance movement of the rationals against the radicals in the GOP.
It's like being on trial for your life with a public defender. Let the jury fill the seats up and start the court calendar off with docket number 9mm. All rise, the Honorable Jay-Z preside. Instead of a mallet, I hold a tool. All objections overruled. Save your opening arguments. Hope you understand it. Two guns, right over left. That's how I cross-examine. Like Tom Cruise, popping with the top gun. You lose. No lie, and y'all can't handle the truth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Miles Taylor, the co-founder of the Renew America Movement, a coalition of over 150 members and former members of the Republican Party calling for strengthening the rule of law and restoring government ethics, having served as chief of staff for Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security during the Trump administration. In 2018, he wrote an anonymous op-ed for the New York Times, providing eyewitness insight into White House chaos, administration instability, and the people working to keep Donald Trump's reckless impulses in check. His subsequent book, a New York Times bestseller, is a warning, and he has an article at the Washington Post, "We Are Republicans. There is only one way to save our party from pro-Trump extremists." Welcome to Background Briefing, Miles Taylor.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Miles. And yesterday, Wednesday, President Trump issued an announcement urging Republicans not to vote in the next elections unless all Republicans in the party adopted his Stop the Steal lie. That seems a little strange. How does it strike you?
Well, you know, look, I'd say that it's one of the sillier things that I've seen him say, and that's really saying something. And frankly, you know, if the former president was serious, that's going to make our efforts to beat his pro-Trump candidates a lot easier if Republicans aren't out there voting. So I'm not sure what the strategy was there, but I'll say, look, you know, big picture, you know, we've got an individual in the former president who is really hell-bent on undermining the democratic process well after his certified loss in the presidential election. And that's one of the reasons we're actually coming out with this candidate watch list this week. I mean, my organization, Renew America Movement, was founded by 150 or so former Republican governors, senators, congressmen, cabinet secretaries, and people who've been the leaders of the Republican Party before, like Michael Steele, with a primary goal of going out there and defeating these political extremists that have overtaken the Republican Party, and to the larger point, denying them from getting majority power in Washington. I think what we learned after the 2020 election is that my party, the Republican Party, really can't be trusted, especially to be the majority in the House of Representatives when it comes to the next presidential election, because they've shown a willingness and a desire to overturn and subvert elections that they lose. And that's the role of the House of Representatives, is to certify the results of elections. So we're very concerned about the Republicans getting the majority in the House. And that's one of the reasons why we've announced a slate of candidates, Republicans that are good Republicans we want to protect, but also unifying moderate Democrats that we as Republicans are willing to support to make sure that Kevin McCarthy doesn't become the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
And the Renew America Movement, or RAM, as you describe it, is a resistance movement of the rationals against the radicals in the GOP.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, look, and we don't say those words lightly either. And let me make a note here is that, I'm not a political person. I've never worked on a campaign in my life. You know, I'm a national security guy and a policy guy. But a lot of us now see this big lie rhetoric and the efforts of pro-Trump GOP extremists as a real national security threat. I mean, this is the type of stuff that for years I saw our foreign adversaries in Russia and China and elsewhere really trying to foment within the United States. They wanted this to happen. They wanted Americans to question the legitimacy of their elections so that they could undermine U.S. influence around the world. So this isn't a political fight to me. This is a national security challenge of the highest order, and frankly, the most serious national security threat I've confronted in my career in the national security community. So we're worried about it. That's why a lot of us have reluctantly entered the political space. But yes, as you note, I mean, we do think this is a fight of rational Republicans against radical ones. And, you know, it pains me to say it. I do think that the rational side is the losing side right now in the GOP civil war. But that's not all grim news, because even though it's on the losing end and the MAGA side has more adherence within the GOP, it doesn't take the majority of the Republican Party to affect the outcome of our politics. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, there are millions of disaffected Republicans, millions of Republicans who want to move on past Trump, who are willing to vote for someone else. And that can create new majorities in elections. So for instance, in 2020, in the presidential election, we managed to convince roughly 7% of Republicans who had supported Donald Trump in 2016 to flip and switch sides and vote for Joe Biden because they were tired of it. Well, what does that 7% come out to? That comes out to millions of Republicans. And a lot of analysts believe that those Republicans flipping sides actually gave Joe Biden the presidency. So we think we can do that again in races in the midterms, is convince Republicans that the pro-Trump people running for Congress aren't suitable for public office, get them to vote for centrists or independents or unifying Democrats while the Republican Party reforms. So that's what we're trying to do, and there's good precedent for it.
And again, I'm speaking with Miles Taylor, the co-founder of the Renew America Movement, a coalition of over 150 members and former members of the Republican Party calling for strengthening the rule of law and restoring government ethics, having served as chief of staff for Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security during the Trump administration. In 2018, he wrote an anonymous op-ed for the New York Times providing eyewitness insight into White House chaos, administration instability, and the people working to keep Donald Trump's reckless impulses in check. His subsequent book, a New York Times bestseller, is a warning. And he has an article in the Washington Post, "We Are Republicans. There's only one way to save our party from pro-Trump extremists." So the idea then, Miles, is to support Democrats, vulnerable Democrats, and independents, and even Republicans. And I guess a good example of that is your support for Evan McMullen, right, in a red state, Utah, which is not likely to elect a Democrat. So rather than have Mike Lee, who is a Trumpster and who's behind the big lie, the Stop the Steal lie, that's the strategy, right, to try and get an independent elected there.
Well, that's one very good example, Ian, is for, you know, listeners who aren't as familiar with politics in the state of Utah. That's a state where Democrats have really very little hope of winning statewide elections. It's been decades since a prominent Democrat has won a statewide federal election there in Utah. But there is an opportunity to run someone who's more moderate. So here's the thinking in that race. Mike Lee, as you know, is the sitting Republican senator from Utah. He's a pro-Trump extremist who tried to overturn the election, supported Trump's efforts to overturn the election. And a Democrat doesn't have much of a chance to beat him. But if in a race like this, the Democrats decide to sit it out and support someone who runs as an independent, someone who previously was a Republican, has center-right credentials, then there's a really good chance of beating Mike Lee. If the Democrats and those disaffected Republicans that I talked about, many of whom in Utah don't like Mike Lee. In fact, I think something around half of Republicans in Utah don't like Mike Lee anymore. Then that shows you that there's a real path to victory for an independent senatorial candidate like Evan McMullen. That is going to be an exciting race, a groundbreaking race. And Evan, of course, is one of the renewers that we announced that we're supporting. He is running as a renewer. But there are other races, Ian, where the inverse is the case, where, you know, we know that Republicans have no chance of winning except a pro-Trump extremist might enter the race, and where it's more suitable for, you know, center-right Republicans to instead support a good Democrat. And we're looking at some of those options. And then there's other cases. The last one I would flag for you that's going to be really interesting to watch is in the state of Pennsylvania. Your listeners will know that Pennsylvania was ground zero in the 2020 election when it came to this fight about certifying our election results. There was a lot of debate about fraud and which way the Pennsylvania votes were going to go, whether it was to Trump or Joe Biden. A lot of eyes are going to be on Pennsylvania because their senator, Pat Toomey, is retiring. He's a Republican, and that's going to be an open seat. And right now on the Republican side, we primarily just see pro-Trump Republicans fighting to get the nomination. But on the Democratic side, there's a number of relatively moderate candidates. So this may be one of those cases where it comes down to a pro-Trump extremist and a relatively moderate Democrat, where we'll go play in that race and urge our fellow Republicans not to support the Trumpers. So a lot of scenarios happening here. It's very dynamic. But look, I'll put an optimistic note on this. This is an exciting time because coalition campaigning, as we call it, reaching across the aisle in this way is a pretty novel approach to trying to reform our democracy and to protect it. So we're hoping that we've got electoral success in November, and it's going to take folks joining the team.
Well, Evan McMullen, who I've interviewed before, is of course a national security guy like yourself. He happened to be in the room some years back when Kevin McCarthy was in discussions with Paul Ryan, at which point Kevin McCarthy said, "I swear to God, Congressman Rohrabacher and Donald Trump are on Putin's payroll," at which point Paul Ryan said, "Well, let's not talk about that." So what happened to Kevin McCarthy? I mean, he's obviously was a rational Republican who was concerned, as a lot of people are, about Trump's loyalty, since he was so much in the thrall of, and still appears to be in the thrall of, Vladimir Putin. And he, of course, made a strong statement after the insurgents sacked the, or tried to storm the Capitol and change the vote. So he made that strong statement, and now, of course, he's absolutely saying the most outrageous lies. Just the other day, he referred to the Select Committee investigating, the House Select Committee investigating January the 6th, saying it's a completely partisan committee. No, you know, it's not bipartisan. Well, we know that Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger are on that committee. And in fact, they're working with your movement, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, look, at both of those are renewers. Both of those are renewer candidates. And look, I'll echo. Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger are no softies, and they're certainly not partisan Democrats. Liz Cheney is about as a rock-ribbed conservative as you can get. Adam Kinzinger, strong national security conservative who's voted with the party for years, served this country in uniform. These aren't Democrat partisans. And look, there's another person on that committee to boot, Ian, that totally makes Kevin McCarthy's point moot. And that's Denver Riggleman. Denver Riggleman, another really strong Republican who served this country in uniform and in the intelligence community. He's a former congressman from Virginia in a deep red district. He's a senior advisor to the select committee. So this is not a partisan effort or a partisan witch hunt in Donald Trump's terms. It's a bipartisan effort to get to the root of what happened on January 6th. But this gets to your bigger question. What happened to people like Kevin McCarthy? And I'll take your anecdote from earlier about Dana Rohrabacher and raise you this anecdote. Is there was another occasion that I was in the room with Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House and Kevin McCarthy when he was Majority Leader, when Paul Ryan said, as Trump was getting closer to clinching the presidential nomination, we've got to stop him. And we've got to create a Trump inoculation plan. And Kevin McCarthy sat there nodding in agreement. I mean, at the time, McCarthy equally agreed we need to stop this rise of Donald Trump. Yet now he's become one of Trump's most prominent supplicants. Why is that? And I think the answer, unfortunately, is pretty straightforward, is a lot of folks here in Washington care more about keeping their job than keeping their courage and standing by their principles. And that's really disheartening. But you know what? There's something we can do about it. And that is when voters spot people like Kevin McCarthy who are willing to switch out their spines to demonstrate total fealty to someone like Donald Trump, they've got the opportunity to vote those people out of office. And I do think that the flip-flopping we've seen among people like Lindsey Graham and Kevin McCarthy and others when it comes to Donald Trump is plenty of reason to kick those folks out of office and put others in their place. But I will say it's been probably the single most dispiriting thing I've seen in my time in Washington, D.C. I've worked in the White House, the Pentagon, Capitol Hill, you know, DHS, all over the place. And I've seen far too many people unwilling to speak out at critical moments out of fear. And the last thing I'll say about that is, while cowardice like that is contagious, courage is also very contagious. When folks stand up, it's scary to be the first one out there because they get attacked. But if there's more folks who come to their defense, you go from being tribeless to having a tribe of the tribeless and having protection to speak out. And that's really what we need to see in Washington, D.C. Now, I talked the other week to my friend Alex Vindman, who, of course, stood up and testified at Trump's impeachment trial very bravely. And he and I were having this conversation. And he said, you know, the objective of intimidation is to silence. And the way to defeat it is to not be silent. And that may sound simplistic, but Alex is right. And so we need more members of Congress speaking up and saying what they say to me behind the scenes. These Republican congressmen still tell me that they think Trump's a lunatic and they want him to go away, but they still praise him in public. We need them to show that courage and to spread it. And I'm still holding out hope that we'll have more people following Liz Cheney's path.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Miles, I recently did speak with Alex Vindman, and he made the point that Donald Trump is the gift that keeps on giving for Vladimir Putin, that Putin's strategy is to exploit the fissures in this country, the divide, the partisan divide, which is now getting to a toxic level, and that Trump is his chief enabler in terms of dividing this country. And I wonder whether that point can resonate with independents and Republicans as well as Democrats, the idea that here we are, this powerful, proud nation, and we're getting manipulated by this gangster in the Kremlin. It's pathetic.
Well, it really is. And Ian, I want to bring your listeners into the inner sanctum here, because early in the Trump administration, we had conversations in the White House situation room the top national security leaders in the federal government talking about these threats. Now, I can't get into the sensitive details of those conversations, but at the big picture, I can tell you, early in the administration, when we were talking about the threat from Russia, our biggest concern was that Moscow would continue to try to interfere in our elections and in our democracy, and that their efforts to divide Americans would be successful if we did not push back very forcefully and at the highest levels of government. And in those early months when we had those debates, we found out that the White House did not want to push back very forcefully, and that at the highest levels of government, the president himself wanted us to wave off. Not only that, he was furious anytime his members of the National Security Cabinet, the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Secretary of State, and others criticized Vladimir Putin. He was furious, and he made it known that he did not want his administration to cause trouble with Russia. All that did was tell our adversaries that it was open season on the United States. Come on in, meddle in our elections, interfere with our democracy, and divide Americans. And that lays at Donald Trump's feet. He set that tone, he set that standard, and guess what our adversaries have done? They've accepted the invitation. They've said, absolutely, we'll take that invitation. This is a national security threat. And partway through the administration, one of the reasons why I quit my job is I felt like not only was the president undermining our efforts at the Department of Homeland Security, he was actively increasing Homeland Security threats to the United States by his unwillingness to stand up to our adversaries and to approve the policies that were needed to protect the country. And now we are where we are. I mean, our adversaries are beside themselves. They cannot believe how successful their efforts have been to divide the United States and how much Donald Trump has enabled those efforts. That's not just hyperbole. That's not a political talking point. That is actually the analysis of what we see happening in these foreign capitals, is they think Donald Trump has been an immensely useful asset in undermining the security of the United States. And that should be alarming to any American, regardless of political party.
Well, Miles Taylor, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Miles Taylor, who's the co-founder of the Renew America Movement, a coalition of over 150 members and former members of the Republican Party, calling for strengthening the rule of law and restoring government ethics. Having served as the chief of staff for Kirstjen Nielsen, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security during the Trump administration, in 2018 he wrote an anonymous op-ed for the New York Times, providing eyewitness insight into White House chaos, administration instability, and the people working to keep Donald Trump's reckless impulses in check. His subsequent book, a New York Times bestseller, is A Warning, and he has an article at the Washington Post, We Are Republicans. There's only one way to save our party from pro-Trump extremists. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Israel's threat that it not just has the right, but a responsibility to stop Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement of the Struggle for Iran's Future, and his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thanks, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And on Wednesday, there was a meeting in Israel between the Secretary of State Blinken, Israel's Foreign Minister Lapid, and the Foreign Minister of the United Arab Emirates, and at which the Israeli Foreign Minister Lapid said, Secretary of State Blinken and I are sons of Holocaust survivors. We know there are moments when nations must use force to protect the world from evil. If the terror regime is going to acquire nuclear weapons, we must act. We must make clear that the civilized world won't allow it. And of course, he's talking about Iran suspending its involvement in the nuclear talks with the United States and the JCPOA. And he went on to say, Lapid went on to say that Israel has not just the right, but a responsibility to stop Iran from acquiring the bomb. So they're fighting words.
It's pretty consistent coming from Israel. That's the position that Israel has taken for a very long time. It underscores that there's not much difference between the new Israeli government and the previous Netanyahu government on this topic. I think these views resonate deeply in the White House, among the foreign policy team of Joe Biden. But I don't think they're going to be able to convince the Biden administration to take a tougher line on Iran than the previous, you know, White House administration of Donald Trump. Of course, Israel wants effectively the United States to go to war against Iran, to bomb Iran on behalf of Israel. I think the Biden administration still wants to pursue a diplomatic settlement if possible. And I really don't think there's a war option here. And we can talk about why I think that's the case.
Well, Blinken, of course, did say in Israel yesterday, we're united in the proposition that Iran cannot be allowed to acquire a nuclear weapon, and President Biden is committed to that proposition. We believe that the diplomatic path is the most effective way to ensure that that doesn't happen. So what is the diplomatic path, given that the talks have been stalled in Vienna since June? And the Iranians are just basically dawdling, and they're saying that we need to get our new team in place from the new president. So what's going on here? There's a concern. The French foreign minister is actually quite alarmed. He's saying that the situation has reached a crisis at this critical moment for the future of the nuclear agreement, and he's blaming Iran for refusing to negotiate.
Well, I think the talks are stalled, as you've correctly pointed out. So there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that the six rounds of negotiations in Vienna that took place from April to June of this year has resolved many of the long outstanding issues. I mean, the people who've been following these talks quite closely say that roughly 90 to 95% of the outstanding issues have been resolved. It's the remaining 5% getting to the finish line where the talks have broken down. And of course, complicating a diplomatic settlement is the fact that there's a new team in power in Iran, a new hardline government in power that has replaced the Rouhani Zarif government that, you know, signed the first nuclear agreement, the JCPOA, in 2015, and has tried to revive it once again. And this new hardline government in Iran is made up of people who, if you follow what they were saying throughout these nuclear negotiations, going back to the very beginning, we're deeply skeptical of a nuclear agreement between Iran and the United States. And there are elements within this new Iranian government that, you know, openly are hoping, I think, for the collapse of these talks because they, you know, have a much more, you know, hard line and draconian position with respect to relations with the West. They don't believe in furthering economic ties with the West. They have a very deeply anti-American position. They think that Iran should be self-sufficient economically and should ally itself much more strongly with China. So the talks are effectively stalled. And the what we're hearing out of Tehran right now is, well, we'll be coming back to the talks very soon. We just want to reassess things. But I think what fundamentally Iran is calculating at this moment is that they are in the driver's seat with respect to the pace of the negotiations and with respect to its relationship with the United States. And, you know, Iran, you know, I think makes the following calculation, which is very convincing. From their perspective, they've withstood the worst of the sanctions that Trump imposed on Iran. There's nothing left to sanction anymore in Iran, so they don't fear further sanctions from the United States or for the West. Secondly, the debacle in Afghanistan has, I think, weighed very heavily on Tehran's calculus in the sense that given the humiliating defeat of the United States in Afghanistan, there is no appetite in Washington for another military engagement in the Middle East that will draw the United States into the region. Everything that we're hearing from the Biden administration has been noted in Tehran in the following sense, that the Biden administration wants to pivot to Asia, wants to deal with you know, China wants to do with climate change, wants to withdraw from the Middle East. So the idea that anyone in Washington is going to stomach, in the aftermath of the Afghan debacle, a military strike on Iran that could lead to another war in the Middle East that would draw the United States in is doesn't seem realistic to anyone, including the people in Tehran. And finally, and most importantly, I think the Iranian regime feels very confident in the sense that they have completely pacified internal opposition to their rule. Society is deeply broken. It's suffering economically. There's a fifth wave of the COVID pandemic that has affected hundreds of thousands of Iranians. All opposition has been silenced. Iran has in its jails, you know, dozens of dual nationals. It's not going to release them until it gets concessions from the West. So when you put it all together, you know, Tehran is saying, look, all the cards look like they're going to play out in our favor. There's no immediate need to rush back to the bargaining table. Let the United States make some concessions and then we'll consider it.
And again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement of the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. So just back to the French foreign minister, who on Wednesday expressed alarm that we're at a critical moment with these nuclear agreements. And he went on to say that Iran is creating facts on the ground that further complicate the return to the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal. So that is implying that they've reached the point of, or are reaching the point of having enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon. Some time back, the Israelis said that it would happen within 3 months. Well, we are 3 months out from that statement. So what do you know about that possibility? I mean, one bomb is not going to, it's significant, but not that significant. But still, it seems to be a threshold that's got a lot of people alarmed.
That's correct. I think a lot of this is really just Iranian bluster to scare the West into making concessions. So yes, Iran is enriching uranium at a higher rate. It is sort of advancing the nuclear fuel cycle. It's making these pronouncements, I think, largely as a bargaining tactic, as you've just hinted at, Ian, a moment ago. One bomb is not a game changer. If you know anything about nuclear strategy, in order to be effective, you have to have an entire family of nuclear weapons. You have to have second strike capability. You have to develop delivery systems. Iran is very far away from that happening. I don't even think that's what they're going for. I think they're using the fear that Iran's nuclear program has generated in the West to try and get the best bargain and the best concessions, more concessions from the West before settling on an agreement. Now, of course, you know, there's a background set of considerations here that, look, this is just an irrational regime, that if it gets the bomb, that's the end of the world. I mean, that's sort of the rhetoric that we hear coming out of, you know, the statements that we hear from Israel and some of its supporters. I think that's gross exaggeration. This is not a suicidal regime. It very much wants to survive, and it's not going to sort of do anything to jeopardize its own survival. So I don't put a lot of stock in the, you know, news reports that we're hearing that Iran is now enriching uranium to 60%, or it's going to up that, as if that's going to be a game changer. That resonates in public opinion. It resonates in sort of some Western capitals. But, you know, factually on the ground, I don't think it's a game changer. I don't think that's what Iran is actually trying to do. I think it's very much trying to, you know, play hardball with the West in order to, you know, maximize its position at the bargaining table.
Well, you mentioned support from China for Iran. Of course, China is a part of the JCPOA along with Russia, but they're clearly not enthusiastic about returning these talks as the Europeans are and the US. There's something else going on too in Iran's favor, if you will, and that is that these secret talks that have been happening between Iran and Saudi Arabia, they began in April. They've had three rounds of talks since then. The last was in September when the new Iranian hardline president had taken office. So there's another round happening in the next couple of days. If Iran manages to peel off Saudi Arabia from this prior coalition that did the Abraham Accords, which is what Blinken endorsed yesterday in Israel with the foreign minister, or at least most of the Abraham Accords negotiated during the Trump administration, which essentially hang out the Palestinians to dry. It's notable that the Saudis were not in this meeting in Israel. The UAE foreign minister was, but not the Saudi foreign minister, and that the Saudis are having these secret talks with Iran. So if they make a deal with Iran, that's the end of that coalition, isn't it?
I have a different reading, Ian. I think these talks that are taking place between Saudi Arabia and Iran, they are significant. Just recently, Iran's new foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, said that they are making great progress. But I don't think the goal here, and I don't think the end result would be Iran appealing Saudi Arabia away from the coalition that it's part of that includes Israel and other Arab states. I think it's very much an attempt by both sides, that is Iran and Saudi Arabia, to de-escalate tensions, to maybe contemplate restarting diplomatic relations, to try and perhaps resolve the conflict in Yemen. It's not to shift Saudi Arabia into a new alliance with Iran. I think the reason why Saudi Arabia has done effectively a 180-degree turn on its relationship with Iran. You know, they were one of the biggest supporters of the Trump administration. They strongly supported American military action against Iran. They were secretly hoping that, you know, Trump would bomb Iran and would engage in the type of regime change that these Washington, D.C. hawks were hoping for, you know, being egged on by the Israelis and the Saudis. I think what Saudi Arabia is doing right now is it realizes that, you know, Biden is in power. Biden supports diplomacy. Biden's trying to pull out of the Middle East. So Saudi Arabia has been forced to recalculate its position with Iran. I think these are very largely cosmetic talks that will not sort of shift the balance of power, will not fundamentally shift tensions between U.S. and Iran in any significant way. They will just lead to some sort of de-escalation in tensions. The Saudis realizing that they no longer have a strong backer in the White House. They have a president in the White House that wants to move out of the Middle East. So Saudi Arabia has to react accordingly. I think that's fundamentally what's going on. I don't think this in any way, you know, undermines the Abraham Accords and the alliance that Israel has struck with various Arab dictators to strengthen its position in the Middle East and effectively screw the Palestinians, as you've noted. That still remains intact. That will not change. And I don't think this fundamentally sort of, you know, shifts the basic regional balance of power. But I think you are right in the sense that Iran views this dialogue with the United States as a small gain. It's sort of, it views that, look, on top of all of the other things that I mentioned earlier about how Iran views itself in a stronger position, it also views that it's having a dialogue with Saudi Arabia as another sort of plus, another sort of feather in its cap, if you will, that suggests that things are moving in Iran's direction.
So just in the last few minutes then, Nada, if the Iranians are feeling in a stronger position and that they can afford to sort of dawdle on these talks and get the Israelis alarmed, and meanwhile the Americans are more interested, or the Biden administration is more interested in dealing with Asia and getting out of the Middle East, Israel, of course, is a nuclear power in the way that you were talking about earlier, having all second strike capability and a lot of different weapons and different delivery systems. They obviously want the U.S. to help them out if they were to have a military strike against Iran's nuclear facilities, but it's unlikely that Biden will go along with that. Can the Israelis go on their own? I don't understand, you know, what the use of nuclear weapons would be, either by the Iranians having one or two bombs, or the Israelis having a mature arsenal. I don't see how either side could actually use a nuclear weapon, but people seem to be concerned that Iran is an irrational country and could hand a bomb over to terrorists.
Yeah, well, first of all, you can't hand a bomb over to terrorists and have them explode it. I mean, the technology and the ability to launch such a weapon just doesn't exist. I think that's the stuff of, you know, Hollywood fiction rather than, you know, factual reality in terms of how nuclear bombs operate. I think you are right in stating that, look, you know, even if Iran gets the one nuclear weapon, it does enhance its power regionally. It also poses great risks because it could invite, you know, a military strike on its facilities to try and take it out. And that speaks to your question whether Israel will go it alone. I don't think it will. Israel knows that it needs a green light from the United States. I mean, U.S. and Israeli foreign policy in the Middle East are closely coordinated. A military strike on Iran's nuclear facilities would launch another Middle East war. The United States and Iran would find themselves into deep conflict, and Iran would start to retaliate, to use its assets throughout the region to sort of, you know, attack American targets, thus drawing the Biden administration into precisely the scenario that they don't want to contemplate, and that is another Middle East war. I mean, that's what the whole Afghanistan project in many ways was about. Despite the debacle, Biden stood firm and saying, look, we need to sort of stop these so-called forever wars. We need to get out of the Middle East. So I don't think that's a realistic possibility. I think what we're hearing from the Israelis is they're hoping that Biden will shift its position, will reconsider its position on Iran. But I suspect what would happen, rather than a strike on Iran's nuclear facilities if the talks collapse, what we'll see probably is a stepped up series of efforts that we've seen in the past from the United States. Clandestine attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities, cyber attacks, trying to delay and roll back Iran's position, Iran's nuclear program. I mean, the United States has been doing this for a very long time. In the last few months of the Trump administration, there was a stepped up effort to attack Iran's nuclear facilities. There were these unexplained explosions that were taking place. Of course, the Israelis assassinated Iran's top nuclear scientist in November of last year. So I expect those types of things are probably going to be much more likely if there's no progress in diplomacy.
Well, Nadashmi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nad Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 5:30.